Hello, you're listening to The Nature Between Us. My name is Tessa and I'm your host. This podcast is produced on the land of the Bidjigal and Gadigal people of the Eora Nation. It pays respects to elders past, present and future and acknowledges their previous and ongoing care for country. No doubt many of us know how good it feels to spend time in nature. But did you know that the act of gardening specifically has huge psychological benefits for our brains, our relationships, and many other aspects of our physical and mental health? In today's episode, I sit down with Sue Stewart-Smith to discuss the positives of digging around in the soil. Sue is a psychiatrist and psychotherapist whose latest book, The Well-Gardened Mind, explores the psychological significance of gardening. A Sunday Times bestseller, Sue combines observation, horticulture, brain science, literature, and history. We speak about her introduction to gardening, her study of horticulture programs within prison systems, why the color green is so relaxing for our visual cortex and brains, and many other interesting insights into the human-garden relationship. Today's episode is the final conversation for season two of TNBU. And in a time when we are plugged into screens and logged onto devices more than ever, I felt this was the perfect way to finish up. A combination of science, human behavior, and our intrinsic connection with nature. A gentle reminder to swap the screen for green. Enjoy. Sue, thank you so much for joining me today on The Nature Between Us. It's a pleasure to have you on the show.
I'm really pleased to be joining you today, Tessa.
I thought maybe a nice place to start would be with your personal journey with gardening, because you mentioned at the beginning of your book, A Well-Gardened Mind, that even up until meeting your husband, Tom, you write that you were a gardening skeptic. You kind of saw gardening almost like a chore. What was it that turned this around for you?
Well, it was a very gradual process, I think. I'd always been a nature lover, and I'd just not had a lot of experience of gardening itself when I was growing up. And I think, you know, I then married my husband in my mid-20s. We were quite young, and we started creating a garden around our home, which is where we still live. And it was hard work. It was, we lived on a windswept hill, and we were surrounded by a lot of mud. And we needed, you know, the first stage of the garden making was all about creating shelter. So, that's, you know, I think one does have to acknowledge gardening can be a real slog as well. But it wasn't until our youngest, we then had three children in quite quick succession. And it wasn't until our youngest was beginning to go to preschool and I had a bit more time and also the garden was beginning to take a bit of shape. You know, I could sort of see that happening around us. And that, you know, that at that point I thought, oh, I'd really like a little corner of this garden for myself to experiment and begin growing things. And I'd always loved cooking. So my way into gardening was really through that. So I started growing things that I wanted to cook with. Initially, sort of interesting herbs that you can't buy in the supermarket. And then quite quickly, I went on to growing vegetables, which I'm still very passionate about. So that was really how it started. And that it was what hooked me in, if you like, was growing produce. And from that, I sort of came to see, I think, many of the other different kind of rewards that one gets from the process of gardening.
Yeah, that's interesting. I feel like gardening for many people, I know it's the same in my family, definitely started with growing what you can eat, because that feels like that's the most immediate reward. It's like the first gateway in some ways to gardening, because you get to eat and fill yourself up with what you grow.
And it tastes better, and you know, you can you know, grow interesting things that are hard to get hold of in any other way.
Yeah,
and it's enormously satisfying, I think.
Yeah,
to feel that, you know, you're doing something that's so tangibly nourishing. So I think that is, you know, I haven't lost that aspect of my love of gardening.
Yeah. And so you describe in the book that there are many different types of gardening. I'm curious if you're able to flesh out what characterizes therapeutic gardening specifically.
Well, I think that gardening as a therapeutic process is something we can all benefit from. You know, and that was one of the things that led me to write the book, was becoming aware, and particularly as I progressed in my career and took on greater responsibility in my work as a psychiatrist and psychotherapist. You know, in time, I ended up running a district psychotherapy service and then taking a lead in on our county. So I was carrying quite a lot of responsibility with my work. And I think I began to notice that the weekends when I'd spent time in the garden and devoted time to that, whether it was weeding or sowing seeds, potting up seedlings and so on, actually that those Monday mornings I went into work feeling calmer and more refreshed. So I think I noticed that first of all in myself. In terms of, you know, the different kinds of, I suppose, forms of horticultural therapy, there's a very wide range, from more informal community-based gardening projects, which can offer a huge amount, particularly to combat social isolation and connect people in urban settings, right through to kind of very specialist projects, you know, some of which, examples of which feature in the book. You know, for example, projects working inside prisons, also working with long-term mental health problems, addiction, for example, and helping people recover from post-traumatic stress. And horticultural therapy has certainly found quite an important role in the treatment of veterans suffering from PTSD. So there's a very wide range, I think, of applications for the benefits of horticulture. And I think very importantly as well, right across the lifespan. You know, I think children benefit from playing in gardens and spending time in nature. I feature a couple of projects with at-risk youth where, you know, the gardening becomes an important source of self-esteem for them. And then at the other end of the life cycle, you know, in old age, gardening gives people at that stage in life, and actually it can give us at any stage in life, a great way of thinking about the future and investing in the future and continuing to do that, you know, right towards the end of life, really.
So it sounds like it's not like a specific type of gardening. It's not like, you know, normal gardening is this, but therapeutic garden, we only dig the soil 3 centimetres deep. You know, there's no rules. It's more just the application of gardening for therapeutic benefits.
Yeah. I mean, you know, and I think some of the fundamental elements to those therapeutic projects, for example, the sense of safe enclosure that people benefit from in a garden, which is crucial for someone recovering from a trauma. For example, someone who's actually got PTSD will be hypervigilant, will be unable to stop scanning a horizon or just sort of checking what's behind them. And the feeling of safety in a garden, and it is a kind of enclosure it's a protected setting and yet not a claustrophobic setting. You know, you've still got views. You've still got vistas, you can see the sky, you can look up at the trees. So there's what psychologists call a good balance of prospect and refuge. So that having those in balance is something that gardens offer, and that's therapeutically very important. But it's something which I think we can all enjoy in a garden. So I don't think there's any clear, as you're saying, no clear demarcation between what's the therapeutic garden and what's, if you like, a more, you know, ordinary garden.
And perhaps all gardeners are benefiting in therapeutic ways and they might not even realize.
I think that may be true. I mean, I think one does have to acknowledge that gardening can be a burden. It can be draining. You know, if your garden is too big for you, or if you're trying to sort of struggle with plants that don't really like your climate or your soil, you know, I think, you know, it's not as if it automatically follows. Mm. But one of the things I've really loved about writing the book and its aftermath is the number of gardeners who have, you know, written to me and messaged me to say, oh, you know, sort of, now I understand better why I feel like I do. You know, I always felt gardening was good for me, and now I understand a bit better why.
Yes, because your book is so well researched, and that's one of the things I really enjoyed about it. It delves really deep into the way our brains work and how we process things like trauma, or even just anxiety, self-esteem, all of these things that, you know, float around in our brains. And it really like explained a lot about how we think and how we behave, which I wasn't expecting, but I maybe should have expected, considering it's called The Well-Gardened Mind.
But the book is very much about the mind as well. Mm. And I suppose I wanted to make the kind of links with between the science on the one hand and the sort of quite commonplace experiences that people describe in gardens. So for example, one thing people often talk about is this feeling of losing themselves in the garden, of becoming so absorbed in what they're doing, that they sort of, you know, they drop their self-consciousness, they stop ruminating or, you know, mulling over things in a negative way, a self-critical way, for example. And you know, that is enormously facilitated by the setting of the garden, that feeling of safe enclosure in a garden, but also through the sort of mindfulness, the kind of state of connection between hand and brain and whatever task you're engaged in, that brings you into the present moment. And that's actually a very important way that people can benefit from gardening. And I think it's been so helpful for so many people during this pandemic, when, you know, anxieties have been to the fore. And also we're all, many of us, spending far too much time on screens and working remotely and, you know, dealing with a remote world, if you like, a virtual world, rather than, you know, something that feels tangible and earthy. And I think the garden is a great antidote for that.
Definitely. What is it about the colours green and blue that calm the brain? Because you speak of this in the book.
Yes, I do. And I think they are undoubtedly very calming. The colour green is said to be the colour that requires least energy from the visual cortex to process. That may be a result of evolution, you know, that it was the most dominant colour around our prehistoric forebears. And blue, of course, water is so essential for survival. There are very good reasons why people might find the presence of water very, very calming. But we also know that the smell of wet earth, for example, which is called geosmin or petrichor, it has two different names, that people are very humans are very sensitive to it, and most people experience it as an attractive smell and a calming and pleasurable smell. So, you know, gardens offer by default really quite a good combination of these elements.
Mm. That really struck me when you spoke about those things in the book, because it made me think about the opposite, which is the color red and yellow, which are quite arousing colors to the brain. And it reminded me of how on our smartphones, whenever we get a notification, we have a little red, it's always in red. And it was like such a contrasting example of things that calm the brain and things that don't do the absolute opposite, that really arouse it and keep it on alert and kind of affect the adrenal system.
I think that's right. And I think those constant interruptions are one of the great sort of pitfalls of contemporary life, aren't they?
Yeah.
A sort of fragmentation of our focus. And, you know, increasingly, I think connection with nature, particularly green nature, you know, is recognized to, we respond to that through a different form of attention, a much more relaxed focus attention that has, you know, sort of brings a more integrated state into the brain, you know, that instead of this sort of fragmented focus, just being in nature itself has an integrating effect on the brain, and has been shown to, you know, induce alpha rhythm, for example, in the brain on EEG studies. Right. have shown that. So that's a kind of, it's a relaxed state and a sort of replenishing state in terms of the neurochemistry. It's linked to the serotonin system. So gardens, you know, we can get some of those effects within a park or within walking in nature, but gardens obviously also provide quite a concentrated dose of those effects.
Yeah, that was something that I wanted to ask you. What are the differences in benefits between gardening versus simply just experiencing nature? Because you speak about kind of an unparalleled closeness and intimacy that someone receives with plants when they garden, and there's kind of that sense of nurture and care that you experience beyond just going for like a bushwalk in a beautiful national park.
Yeah, I think gardening, a lot of people see it as a, you know, as an activity or a hobby, which of course it is, but I think fundamentally it's a relationship. And I think it's a relationship with place, and it's a relationship with the plants and the trees that you're tending and caring for. So I think it is about entering into a relationship. And one of the things that I was really keen to emphasize in the book is the value of care for our mental health, for good mental health, of being able to express care for something. Because I think that, you know, culturally we've come to see care, or we're prone to seeing care as potentially a depleting activity, or even maybe a demeaning activity. But actually the neuroscience behind care and nurture shows us that it's actually very bound up with our endorphin system, our natural opioid system, as well as the hormone oxytocin, which is often sometimes called the love hormone, the sort of bonding hormone, and these both have very positive effects on mood and have intrinsic anti-stress effects. So whilst care can, of course, be, if it's onerous, care can be draining. Fundamentally, you know, caring, and it doesn't have to be plants. It may be animals as well, you know, and obviously people, you know. But acts of care are replenishing, and very, yeah, very, very, very good for our self-esteem as well, I think, to feel that we've been able to do that and enter into, I think, a different kind of relationship from the sort of, I suppose, a relationship of consumption and materialism that it's, you know, it's quite hard to avoid these days. In everyday life.
Yeah. You kind of write that gardening is almost like a conversation, you know, like you do a little bit, you go to bed, you wake up in the morning, nature's done a bit, and then you do a bit more, and kind of it's this conversation between you and the environment. What do you think this teaches us kind of about interacting with our environment and respecting natural processes? And then kind of like on top of that, do you think this gardening could be kind of like the perfect, like the perfect advocate for enticing people into caring more for the protection of our natural world?
Yes, goodness, there's quite a lot of questions packed into that.
Sorry.
They're all related, so that's fine. I'll just launch it. But yes, I do. I mean, gardening, you know, if you look at the history of gardening, you know, you can see, you know, the history of humankind's relationship with nature sort of writ large in the way people garden. So, you know, gardening can, of course, be about control and dominion over nature. So it's not always, but sometimes quite often isn't that good for the environment. You know, I mean, I think, you know, the sort of water guzzling, immaculate green lawn is, you know, is the antithesis in a way of what I'm talking about. But what I wanted to encourage people to think about is that it is about how gardening can be a way of entering into a more reciprocal relationship with nature and a more responsive relationship to place, you know, because often those kind of green lawns are growing in places that, you know, they really shouldn't, you know, where it takes a lot of resources to kind of do them to overcome the heat or whatever. So absolutely about gardening with nature and then, yes, entering into a kind of a to and fro, a dialogue. I think the kind of attention to plants that we can form through gardening is very important, you know, noticing what plants need and how they respond. So I think all of that relationship can, I think, very naturally extend itself to the broader relationship, the bigger question of how we treat the planet, you know, how we treat our civic environments too, our urban environments. You know, there's a big campaign that's been running throughout the whole of May in the UK this year, which is called No Mow May. And it's about everybody, you know, domestic gardeners as well as councils in town centres, not mowing during May in order to let the grass grow, to let the flowers bloom that will sustain the pollinators and other insects. And that's been a very successful campaign, and it's been running for a few years and it's beginning to have an impact. So I think that's just one example, I think, of how that relationship how we can change the way we think about our environment and how we manage our surroundings.
Yeah. For a moment there, I thought you were going to say, and men also didn't mow their moustaches, but...
That would be quite a different thing, wouldn't it? I mean, you know, of course, some around the country, it's not as if all councils paid any heed to this, but some did. Mm. And, you know, it developed into quite a big campaign on social media. And I think, you know, every year it comes around, it's having a bit more of an effect, and the penny is beginning to drop. Mm. You know, unless we sustain our insect populations, you know, the decline is so serious at the moment. We have got to do that. Otherwise, we are facing a serious crisis.
Mm, definitely. And you speak about the urban space in your book because, as we know, you know, over half of our global population live in cities. And so our connection with nature is somewhat compromised in that sense, because we are living in these very concrete environments where nature is quite groomed, I suppose, you know, like you're just saying how the gardens get mowed often and everything's quite neat and tidy and controlled. Do you think that gardening in the urban space, you made mention to community gardens, but I'm also thinking maybe even like apartment gardens or, you know, backyard gardens, things like that. Do you see them playing a really big part in helping us urban dwellers reconnect with nature?
I think undoubtedly so. And I think firstly, urban gardens have a very positive effect on people's mental health and levels of stress. You know, I cite a number of different studies in the book showing that, for example, levels of cortisol, the stress hormone cortisol, are reduced in people who live near green spaces compared to those who don't. So there's an immediate health benefit, a public health benefit, if you like. But on top of that, you know, there's another effect of gardens which really intrigued me when I came across it in the research, which is sometimes called the pro-social effects of nature on us. And what that means is that having plants around us, trees, and actually applies to indoor plants too, office plants and so on, that this helps shift our psychology towards being a bit more open to other people, you know, coming up with more generous responses in tests. I mean, these have all been shown in research studies, and also greater empathy towards others. So I think that's a very important effect. And I think as we're coming out of the pandemic, I think that effect could be really, really crucial in helping communities come back together again, you know, to combat the social isolation that's been so severe for so many people. So I think that's a very intriguing and often, you know, it's not necessarily a common sense effect of nature. You know, many people recognize that, you know, getting outdoors is good for you, as it were.
Mm. Yeah, I've often heard, and I mean, even in my own research for my master's, I've read reports about, or studies about how, you know, experiencing nature is really good for us. But I think it hadn't really hit home until I experienced your book, and just specifying the parts of our brain, you know, the amygdala, the left and right sides, and how we need to kind of separate them at some points, and how we are living in such a world where we're very cerebral, and we use one side of our brain a lot more than the other side, which isn't really historically how humans were. And so we're kind of it's almost like we're putting more emphasis on this one muscle, and the other one's just kind of becoming a little bit weak in a way.
Yes, I think that's right. I mean, I think it's, you know, it's not only about the different hemispheres in the brain, it's also, I think, about the mind-body connection, and in particular the importance of using our hands. You know, I describe the work of Kelly Lambert, a neuroscientist who's based in the States, and her work on looking at how having an opportunity to have a direct encounter with material reality, if you like, to shape it in some way and to sort of to grasp something with your hands, literally. So this is not only about gardening. It involves, you know, other crafts and all sorts of other activities, and also for children, physical play, you know, manipulating the world through our hands, shaping a part of our lives in this way. How, in terms of the brain's function, this really strengthens the connections in the brain that can make people more resilient to stress, reduce anxiety, but also to feel a bit more grounded in themselves, a bit less prone to the, you know, when something goes wrong, to catastrophize about it, but to feel maybe, you know, to feel they've got some resources to manage something. And it seems as if the brain really does need quite a lot of endorsement from external reality, from something very tangible that helps us feel that. So, and I think that's one of the things that a lot of people get from their gardens, is just feeling it's part of their life, that they can shape a little bit, you know, that they can make plans for. And of course, not everything's under our control. In a way, it'd be a bit boring if it was, you know. It's that fact that we constantly have to negotiate, whether it's the pests or the weather and so on. But still, it's an endeavour where we can look at something afterwards or harvest something and know that we've had a hand in its making. And I just think in the 21st century, with so much, you know, swiping screens and clicking buttons and so on, that's a very important form of experience to just include in your life, really.
Yeah. And I mean, we're not having a conversation without acknowledging that gardens can be difficult. I mean, my dad's a phenomenal gardener. He's grown a lot of our food through my whole life, but he recently tried to grow some garlic. And I think the soil at my family home is quite sandy because we're on the coast. And for whatever reason, you know, waited 6 months and pulled up nothing that was edible. Oh, and it was so sad. Yeah. I was like, oh no, even the best gardeners have yes, their moments.
Yeah. No, I've had similar experiences with certain things here. And one of the things I write about in the book is our attempt at making a rose garden very early on. And, you know, our soil really didn't suit it and suit them rather. And, you know, after 10 years, we sort of threw in the towel and pulled the roses up. And I was very sad. I loved them, but, you know, they weren't thriving. Mm. So, So it is that you have to work with what you've got. But do you know that in itself is a metaphor for life too, isn't it, really?
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, you have to make the most of the conditions that you find yourself in, you know, whether that's your soil or your climate. Or,
yeah. And that was something that struck me, is that how gardening could teach us to be resilient, not necessarily resilient, but open to adapting, to change. You know, okay, oh, that's not working. Let's try this. Because I think we can, in our kind of very structured lives where we have jobs and, you know, schedules and meetings, and we just kind of do live quite structured lives nowadays. You know, we take the same train every day. We get into these really strong habits. You can kind of forget or not realize that you are resistant to change or adapting to a situation.
No, I think that working with change and growth is very beneficial. And actually, it can be beneficial at a very profound level as well. It was one of the things that came across very strongly in the interviews I did with prisoners, for example.
Yes.
Was actually, you know, these were people who wanted to change their lives, but just, you know, had failed to, for some of them on numerous occasions. You know, they'd reoffended, they were back in jail. And it sort of despaired of that in a way, and we're carrying quite a lot of shame and very low self-esteem. And through gardening, through working with the force of growth in nature, I think just, you know, as we do that, we internalize some of that, and it sort of opens up that possibility of, oh, you know, maybe I can do a bit more myself, you know, and to look at something you've done and feel proud of it for somebody like that, you know, something that they've grown, for example, can make a huge difference to self-esteem. You know, if for someone who's never felt proud of or never been made to feel good about something they've done, gardening provides a very accessible way to feel that. And of course, not everything always works out, but that's also part of it. Because if you grow enough different things, I mean, if your father had only been trying to grow garlic, it would have been a major disaster, wouldn't it? But I'm sure he was growing lots of other things too. You hedge your bets, you know, and if that one doesn't work out, you just have to shrug and say, oh, well, you know, you either try again next year or you decide, okay, it's not meant to be in this plot, you know.
No, he is trying again. I was up there yesterday and he's trying again, so... I'll let you know how it goes.
Yes, exactly.
I'm glad you brought up the prison systems and how prisons are all over the UK are using horticulture therapy programs, because I wanted to touch on that just really quickly. What was your experience like going to places like Rikers Island and speaking with inmates who were undertaking these horticulture therapy programs? I'm so intrigued by that because it sounded like such a positive program for them.
Yes, it was an extraordinary experience. And just to clarify for your listeners that Rikers Island is in America.
Oh, okay.
So, there are, of course, lots of good horticultural projects within UK prisons. But I didn't get permission to actually go in and interview prisoners. I managed to visit one prison garden, but I was extremely fortunate at Rikers through the Horticultural Society of New York, who run the program there, in being able to talk to prisoners inside the prison while they were working on the program. And it was very revealing and actually deeply moving at times, because the project meant so much to them. And one of the things I think that's very special about that program, and also the other American program that I write about, which started in San Quentin Jail in California, is that they not only have a project inside prison, but they have very good links with community projects outside, so that prisoners who get interested in horticulture, want to take further, can become an intern or a volunteer on a community program, perhaps greening projects in deprived parts of the city, for example. And I think that's really crucial to the success, because it's when people first come out of prison that they're most vulnerable to reoffending. When you compare the reoffending rates for prisoners who complete these programs, so the reoffending rates, the normal reoffending rates, as it were, are quite impressive. So 60% of people in American prisons are back inside after 3 years. That's the kind of norm, if you like. But for the Hort and the Insight gardening program, that level is really so much lower. It's 10 to 15% who reoffend. So that's a really dramatic result, I think. And I think it is, a lot of it is down to the fact that you kind of plant, it's like you plant a seed in somebody's mind about, you know, the possibility of changing their life while they're in prison. And, you know, some of the prisons I interviewed were serving sentences of, say, 6 or 9 months. But that may not be long enough to really help somebody change their life completely. And then when they have that opportunity to continue gardening afterwards and feel they're contributing to a community, you know, it is a form of reparative justice, I think. That makes an enormous difference.
Yeah, and I loved the anecdote, or the one inmate in particular you spoke of, Simon, who through gardening, he reconnected with his mum, which was really lovely to hear that it also kind of helps rebuild relationships with people who you're, you know, you maybe have had like a strained relationship with, because there was something there that they can connect over and he could feel proud of those feelings that you've kind of mentioned already. That was really lovely.
Yeah, and I came across that effect in other settings as well. You know, the fact that, for example, some of the at-risk kids I interviewed and the programs they were working on, you know, that they were able to take produce home. And that was so helpful in terms of the way their families, who maybe were looking at them as someone who dropped out of school or whatever, wasn't doing very well, and then they bring this delicious food home that they've been growing. So I think one of the great strengths of gardening is this sharing that can come about through it. You know, whether that's shared pleasures one can take in, let's say, beautiful flowers, but also sharing produce, you know, the very practical level of sharing food.
Oh, I feel like we could talk about this for hours, but maybe it's a good time to wrap up and hear a little reading from the book from you, Sue.
Oh, yes, Tessa, I think that's a nice idea, a nice way of ending off. I'm going to read the last two paragraphs of the book, I think, since we're at the end of the podcast. It's from the final chapter called Green Fuse. In this era of virtual worlds and fake facts, the garden brings us back to reality. Not the kind of reality that is known and predictable, for the garden always surprises us. And in it, we can experience a different kind of knowing, one that is sensory and physical and stimulates the emotional, spiritual, and cognitive aspects of our being. Gardening is, in this sense, simultaneously ancient and modern. Ancient because of the evolutionary fit between brain and nature, and also ancient as a way of life between foraging and farming that expresses our deeply inscribed need to attach to place. Modern because the garden is intrinsically forward-looking and the gardener is always aiming for a better future. Cultivation works both ways. It is inward as well as outward. And tending a garden can become an attitude towards life. In a world that is increasingly dominated by technology and consumption, gardening puts us in a direct relationship with the reality of how life is generated and sustained, and with how fragile and fleeting it can be. Now, more than ever, we need to remind ourselves that first and foremost, we are creatures of the earth.
That was Sue Stewart-Smith. If you're interested, I highly recommend digging into her book, A Well-Gardened Mind, no pun intended. And you can keep up to date with her on Instagram at Sue Stewart-Smith. As this is the final episode of season 2, I'm also going to give one last reminder of the incredible giveaway I'm running with the pod's proud supporters, Spooked Kook Surfboards, Camp Cove Swim, and 4 Purpose Recycling. who have all donated towards two mega prize packs, including a $250 gift voucher from Camp Cove Swim, a recycled plastic belt that funds waste services in Indonesia from For Purpose Recycling, and a brand new Frankenfish soft top surfboard that contains post-consumer plastic. All you have to do to enter the draw is leave a rating and review for the pod on Apple Podcasts with your real name so I can find you, and follow every account on Instagram. Catch all the details at the pod's Insta at the Nature Between Us podcast. I'll be drawing the winner out of a hat in a week or so, so get reviewing. It's been an absolute pleasure having you tune in for the second season of The Nature Between Us. I hope you've loved each conversation as much as I have, and I just want to say another very warm thank you to all of the guests who came on this season. It was an absolute pleasure to have you. I'll be taking a small break to finish my master's research, which I'm doing on seaweed, but I'll be back with a third season sometime next year. Much love and happy hiking until then.